Hello, friends, and welcome to my reflections to episode 51 with Philip Robb, the CEO of Model Number, which is a company looking to 3D print furniture out of food waste. The first thing I did when Mohammed Mudaris recommended that I have Philip on my podcast was go over to the website and see, well, what does 3D printed furniture actually look like? Is it comfortable? Is it fun? Which parts of it are actually customizable? How do you even sell furniture online? And maybe most importantly, how much is this all going to cost? I was curious to understand which parts of the furniture were going to be 3D printed, which parts were going to be assembled, how much was actually customized, and whether or not I could afford it before hopping on the call with Philip. For those of you who share the same questions, I think the best thing to do is just head over to the website. You can find it by typing Model Number Furniture on Google, just to get all of the context before listening to either the podcast or my reflections. Anyways, with that being said, let's get back to the interview. I have to admit that before interviewing Philip, when I was doing my research, I was really thinking to myself, does the world really need another furniture company? After all, I think this is one of the core struggles of anyone who's in the environmental movement, is that the most sustainable thing that you can do is just buy less. It's not even buying more sustainable, it's actually just buying less. Nothing will use up less resources than reusing something for a longer period of time. But that being said, I think it would be too idealistic to envision a future in which people just stopped buying things altogether. I mean, I think it's literally impossible to envision a future in which people just stopped buying, because the desire to consistently upgrade or improve our lives is there. So how might we do that in a more sustainable way? And I think that's what Model Number here tries to accomplish. Ultimately, Model Number is trying to pioneer a new paradigm. They're not just trying to invent new shapes of furniture and give you 25 different chairs that you can get or 13 different desks. They're trying to pioneer a brand new paradigm in which furniture is only made when needed. And when it is made custom fitted for the needs and wants of the customer. And then it's also done using, hopefully, local and sustainable materials, which is all really interesting. And I guess if you need to start somewhere, why not start at furniture if that's a field that you're passionate in? Personally, furniture isn't that interesting to me as a human being, probably because I'm a little bit of a nomad more than anything else. But I can totally see how it could be an entry point into a wider conversation. Because if it's possible to succeed with such large, high-ticket, valuable, expensive, really hard-to-ship items, then it should be possible for smaller objects too. And so in some ways, this conversation for Philip was a peek into a future in which more of our products in general, regardless of what they are, could be 3D printed across microfactories across the country. And why not take this same idea, this same business model, and move it on into food? If we look back to the conversation that I had with Josh Balk in episode 27, who is the VP of the Humane Society and co-founder of Just, he talks about how cell-grown meat and plant-based meats are sort of like the Tesla of the food world, and that sooner or later, we're going to hit a point where it just becomes more efficient, cheaper, healthier to 3D print food. And so this basic idea of 3D printing goods in microfactories scattered across the country, organized by proximity, organized by locally available resources, does feel like something worth pioneering. Beyond just talking about the sustainability of furniture, I actually was really curious to hear Philip talk about his past job at the company he co-founded called Beta, primarily because I'm personally just a huge fan of the store. It has nothing to do with sustainability, it has nothing to do with impact. If anything, it's like a Kickstarter store in real life, like a teenager Toys R Us, where all the different cool gadgets and gizmos that you might see on a Kickstarter campaign, from electrical scooters to smart appliances to digital typewriters to bone conducting headphones, you could basically just waltz into this store and play and touch all sorts of really cool toys. And I was really curious to hear from Philip what lessons that he learned from Beta could potentially be ported over to the sustainability world. Because what if you could create a showroom of cool futuristic materials that were green and regenerative and technologically advanced? And what if it wasn't just materials, but also things you could buy? I think the sustainability world is sort of this low-tech, guilt-driven place where it's saying, buy this thing because it'll be better. But at the end of the day, it's just like, it's just a metal straw or it's just a utensil kit. And the amount of innovation in it is fairly low, even on projects that are pretty popular, like Final Straw, as an example, where they have this really cool foldable straw with new materials, it's still quite basic. And so was there a way to combine the future of technology with the future of sustainability and the future of nature all in one place? We did a little bit of poking around. I asked him a bunch of questions. He talked about the importance of storytelling. He talked about the importance of how the physical experience and the digital experience were not actually two separate channels, but really one and the same. And so there should be some cohesion between all of them. And we never really got to the meat of the issue. And I think it was probably because at the end of the day, Philip is currently the CEO of Model Number, which is where all of his attention is focused on. And he's not really involved with Beta anymore since he stepped down as president during the pandemic. And so thinking of what a sustainable Beta might look like is not really his current focus, unfortunately for me. But that's something I personally just thought would be so exciting and so needed in this world, because the worlds of technology and innovation are often separate from that of sustainability. And even when sustainability is a piece of the puzzle, it's not kind of the core underlying latticework of why the technology exists and how it's created. It's more, oh, this is one edition of one shoe that is made out of ocean plastics, or we've now made this other product out of 10% of recycled material. So it's always like token greenwashing, for lack of a better phrasing. And that's not to say that it's bad. In many ways, we need to celebrate progress over perfection. But I just want to be in a space of sustainability and environmentalism where I'm inspired rather than dragged down by all the terrible statistics and so forth. Anyways, I found it really interesting when looking at this conversation from a third-party perspective, because it's called into question how I do my storytelling personally. Like, what am I doing to spread narratives of hope? What am I doing to provide access to solutions as opposed to just highlighting problems all the time? And that's actually a topic that was brought up by John Hagel in episode 33, founder and co-chairman of Center for the Edge at Deloitte. And it's been pretty top of mind as of late, especially. And I think the reason why telling narratives of hope is so much harder than narratives that are based around threats is that narratives of hope are built around solutions. They're built around what's possible. And in order to know what is possible, you need to be able to be knowledgeable enough to understand the situation inside and out, to dream bigger and to visualize what the next stage could be or could look like. Whereas for narratives of threat, all that you really need is a bad statistic to say how bad things are going and how it's terrible and point fingers at the people that are doing things wrong. And it's been pretty top of mind, especially of late, because I'm currently building a project around ocean plastics. And it's obviously an issue that's been covered left, right, and center by so many different people in so many different industries. And there are far more problems than there are solutions. Because oftentimes when we look at problems, we look at them on a global scale. But when we look at solutions, we look at them on a local scale, at least to start with. And until local solutions become global, there's this huge gap in time where things just feel frustratingly overwhelming. And so as a storyteller and an activist, how do you reconcile between those two realities? How do I ensure that I can simultaneously paint a picture of possibility while also holding space for the very real threats that exist? I don't have the answers, but those are the questions that I'm asking myself a lot these days, and increasingly wondering if I truly want to be in the world of activism, because you're sort of constantly surrounded by this negativity and this urgency and this imminent catastrophe that's just looming above you, and it's getting a little bit tiring. Anyhow, it's conversations like this that always forces me to look at whatever it is I'm working on through a different lens, and that's just always very helpful. And I hope that you're finding it helpful too to listen to these random reflections and rambles. If there's anything you'd like improved on these reflection segments, do let me know. I'd love to hear from you on how I can make this more engaging or more relevant to the work that you're doing. And with that being said, folks, I hope you have a wonderful week. Stay positive, stay curious, because impact is everywhere.